I've been thinking a lot about this whole term spiritual activism in the sense that I can imagine it three different ways, and I think they're all valid. Spiritual activism can be an activism aimed in any direction, the energy for which is fueled by a spiritual connection. It can be an activism that goes in any direction that is inspired, that was inspired by a spiritual vision of some kind. And it can be a more direct activism in spirit. Can be more like a Sri Aurobindo wanting to evolve consciousness, pursuit of spirituality, where it's not aimed at any particular social problem, but it's aimed at the elevation of consciousness in general. And I think they're all valid and they all happen. And I find your case interesting. You, from a young age, really devoted your life to spirituality and to enlightenment. And you were with Nisargadatta very early in your life and early in his teaching career. And we shared a spiritual community for a couple of decades. And as far as I know, you can correct me, it was after that community ended that you really got focused on more direct activism in the world.
Yes, I think that's accurate. I mean, I would say that the threads of that, in terms of being politically aware globally, in terms of social justice issues, that has been something that was with me from very early on.
And so, what inspired you to get as actively involved in various causes as you are now?
Probably the main one that I have been involved in that you're referring to and really is the climate activism. It's been more in the form of nonviolent civil disobedience as well. And I would not have expected, I wasn't expecting that, Jeff, at this point in my life. But I think that one of the things, one of the threads through my whole life, and you're right, the first years in my 20s when I was in India and the time I was with Nisargadatta, et cetera, and then afterwards I was in a, wasn't really a Buddhist community, but living in Kent in England, but et cetera, et cetera. I've been involved. Really, my focus was on, well, I was a seeker, right? I was seeking. But where that came from was from when I was very young. I remember literally probably 13, 14 years old, I remember looking out actually at a huge sort of family event. There was a lot of people. And I remember at that age thinking, wow, is this all it really is about? What is it really about? It wasn't an unpleasant event, but I just felt the smallness of my life and our lives, right? Human lives. And that started me really, on a whole path, from then on in. And so I spent a lot of time, years and years, as many of us did, trying to find, the classic thing, looking for the deeper meaning, why we, of existence really, and why we're here, et cetera, et cetera. So I always felt somehow it was always to do, my spiritual seeking was also to make sense of the world and the kind of world. And so fast forward, one of the things that really attracted me to Andrew Cohen, the spiritual teacher we were both with for years, was his connection fairly quickly on. At first, he was more, as we know, in the invited non-dual tradition. His teachings were about waking up, et cetera. But not that far in, maybe 10 years out of 30 or whatever, he made the transition to looking at the relationship between that and the world or culture, the creative capacity of consciousness, like how does consciousness relate to the world? That just, I'll never forget that transition that spoke very deeply to me, Jeff. And that really is probably why I stayed the whole time I did, despite, as we know, there are a lot of issues and problems that developed in that community. But I had never met a spiritual teacher who articulated that connection as much, except interestingly enough, when I was studying at university, I studied, you know, this South Asian philosophy, Indian philosophy, and the whole notion or concept of Dharma expressed through the Upanishads really always spoke to me. It was because that's all about the relationship between the cosmos, the absolute God, whatever ones, and human life and human society and human organization and creation, really. So their whole the basis of Indian, not even going to say Hindu, but Indian philosophy, Indian life, Indian spiritual tradition is rooted in that, you know, that life is not separate from spirit. One's whole life is about manifesting that, coming to manifest that as fully as one can. That's the waking up process in that context. So when Andrew, you know, some 30 years on, started articulating that in a contemporary context, I don't know, it spoke to my heart and my soul really profoundly. And you know, it motivated me too. I really, it gave purpose to, it felt like the natural next step of everything I'd done. So then fast forward to the end of the community. I think, you know, I for the first 2 years, my attention really was on what had happened and trying to understand it myself, et cetera, and re, you know, really get a much fuller picture. I realized my picture had been quite narrow. So once that had happened, I'd moved to London, and Steve and I were starting to have just conversations in our living rooms, salons, whatever you want to call them. And we, our attention began to, we began to engage with, in London, there's always a lot going on. We began to start attending events and going to discussions and meeting different people and realizing, wow, there's a lot of people out there who are actively doing a lot in the world that are motivated by something deeper, even if they don't articulate that. But we could sense that. And we were drawn to that. So it wasn't sort of activism devoid of spiritual, a spiritual basis. So there was a, I think, a natural transition. Plus, I had always been interested in history and global politics. I'm not interested in small politics, but that the global, how do we live together as a globe? I think as a global body had always also interested me as even as a young student. So these things were always there, I think. And then what happened is, I think we've all become much more aware of the climate crisis over the last decade. And I, you know, I became really aware that this could be an existential threat. There's always threats. I've lived through the nuclear threat, you know, et cetera, you know, where there's always threats. But this I felt was, I began to sort of sense, I don't know why, but that this was a really quite serious. So at a certain point, I think it was in 2017, I actually went, I flew to Pittsburgh and I did one of Al Gore's 3 day seminars, 3 day conferences where he brings all these scientists together and he does it for free, which is amazing. And you get this sort of powerful induction into the world of climate. And I did it because I wanted to know Jeff, because at that point there was still a lot, you know, a lot being said different ways about it. And I really wanted to know. I wanted to know how real this was. And I think, you know, and I've said this at different places, I've spoken about this, but it's true. The thing that impacted me the most, there was a lot of data and a lot of very important, you know, information. I mean, I learned a lot. It was like a university. But the thing that impacted me was I could see these scientists who were specialists in certain fields. There was someone from the Barrier Reef in Australia, and I remember him weeping. Their deep, really deep concern and for some heartbreak really impacted me along with all the information. So I came back feeling, wow, you know, this is, I think also I do have two little grandchildren. So the future generations, it's not an abstract for me. It's not just about them, but that's real. I know. This is them, their generation. So all of those things began to work together. in a certain point, I started to go to all. I went, first of all, I did join the, I went and investigated the Extinction Rebellion, because just then the climate movement was building in Britain and around Extinction Rebellion. And I went to the very first large, and 30 odd thousand people turned up for that and occupied central London for 10 days. It was extraordinary. But what really drew me to that was there were nine principles underneath it that were all based on nonviolence. So that was my initiation. It came out of a small group. One was a farmer, an organic farmer called Roger Hallam, who's quite a controversial person, figure, which I understand why. And another one was Gail Bradbrook, who is a scientist, and several others, Claire O'Farrell, who still runs that, and others too. They came together and they all felt this, they came from different traditions, you could say. They've all had civil experience of this. Also, Roger Hallam had done a lot on how do you transform society. Gail Bradbrook, the scientist, had too. They were looking at social movements that can transform society. I think he had done a master's on that at King's College, because they were interested in not just holding a protest, but creating a social movement that could lead to social transformation. And that's why it's different than just a protest. It's more to do with nonviolent civil disobedience, which also attracted me, Jeff, because I was obviously, from all the years in India, I was aware of Gandhi. I was aware, I'd done quite a lot of work reading about, sort of colonialism and the movements that came out of that, and etc. A lot of, I've been doing a lot of that kind of research over the last years. So I was aware of the of nonviolent disobedience as a mechanism for social transformation. And that was behind Extinction Rebellion and has, been the foundation of the activism. And I went on from there. And what really motivated me, though, to get quite involved is in 2021, 22, where I got more involved, was at a certain point, the government here, at first it was quite impacted, and the parliament, they declared a climate emergency. And what how people say is climate activism or any activism effective? I always say yes. We went from totally coming out of COVID, where the press was, media was absolutely, cover to cover, just one thing. There was nothing about the climate. And at this point, I was attuned to the fact this is an existential crisis. So what Extinction Rebellion did in those first 2 years, particularly, that it had these giant, big, huge sort of protests in central London over days, basically shut the city down. What they did was bring it into public consciousness, which is what the aim was. And the second one was the government did declare a climate emergency. So it had quite an effect. And I saw that in both Steve and I. We actually trained as nonviolent trainers of the activists to do nonviolent activism, etc. Got quite involved, because I saw too for myself that nonviolent, it's not just not about being violent. It's actually a spiritual practice, which I could relate to from my own past. You do a lot of training to go out on these actions. So that training, I felt that this was not just a lot of people think of activism as being against, whereas to me, this was really action for transformation, for change. And the way it was done, there was tremendous attention given to, it's very disciplined. Really, when you go out in an action, for example, your very much attention is put on why you're doing it. What's the deepest reason that you're doing this? Because that also gives the energy, it creates the right sort of mindset. You're connected to that. And nonviolent disobedience, in the training of that, you also learn, you understand that the people that you're going to be obstructing, which is a very hard thing, you develop empathy for them, because you realize you are actually putting them out through the action that you're going to be doing. And you learn to let go, you learn to surrender no matter what. So, for example, usually some form of protest is inconveniencing somebody, usually quite a lot of people. And that's a hard thing as an activist. That's probably one of the hardest things that you have to come to terms with, is that you're doing this knowing that you're going to be putting people out. So that's why you need to be very in touch with why you're doing it, the deeper motivations.
And a lot of these actions, they're quite extreme.
Yes, some of them are. Yes, definitely.
Can you give us an example of one of the more extreme? I know they're not all extreme, because it shows a level of commitment where you have to be motivated by something very deep to be willing to subject yourself to these kind of actions.
Before I go to an example, I think a lot of people have thought, oh, Mary's become an activist. Oh, she's given up the spiritual life. Some don't think that, but I know some people do. And I understand if you step way back why they think that. But I think it comes from a misunderstanding of activism, spiritual activism, as you described in the beginning, particularly the first one. Because to be honest, for me, Jeff, it was a choiceless, I have to say that. After I had participated for the first few years in Extinction Rebellion, the government began to sort of, oh yeah, they're out in the streets again. It had no impact. So what happened was I heard this talk given by actually Roger Hallam, and it was titled Our Responsibility at the time at this time or something like that. And I listened to this talk and I literally felt calling. I just felt despite myself, to be honest. And he was calling for radical, the next step, some radical actions, again, non-violent, but much higher stakes. And higher stakes here meaning arrest, prison, whatever, all of those potentials, as well as popular antipathy, put it that way, because they were radical. So, but I listened to this thing, and interesting enough, I passed it over to Steve. I said, you should listen to this, just listen. I didn't say a word to him, and he had exactly the same response. It was somehow spoke to Jeff. What it spoke to in me is the part of me that feels, I feel like, I think that the spiritual impulse is one fundamentally of love. That's what it, to me, it is the impulse, right? You have, there's being again. To me is intelligent. There's an intelligence, inherent intelligence in being. There's also an inherent care in being, I would say. And I think this, as we talked about before, the transition in Andrew Cohen's teaching from just sort of waking up to actually how does, I think he used to call it, how does consciousness affect culture? To me, that's a lot to do with the spiritual impulse, which is about love, is fundamentally positively motivated, has a motivation of positivity. So I think, and I thought a lot about this, I think there's difference, two sides to that. I mean, there's probably many more, but one is that it's creative, that positivity, it's creative, it's for creating, making the manifest realm better. It's evolutionary in that way, but it's also protective. And that spiritual impulse, I think, when I listened to this talk about a more radical form of, because the government at that point was doing nothing, climate was getting worse and worse, progressively manifesting around us every day. And I felt, I think it was that's protective. There's this impulse that of a calling of responsibility. And I kind of felt at that point, look, I can do this. I'm in a position to do this. I don't have young children. I'm not working a job, so to speak. And I've lived an incredibly, you could say, privileged life. I've had a lot of very hard times, like all of us, but I've been fortunate to make my own choices most of the time, and et cetera, et cetera. And I just feel, my goodness, the future is really there's no one at the helm. The future is at risk. It's really perilous. This is a perilous time. And because of the enormity of climate, as we spoke about, there's always been existential risks to life. But the enormity of this and the speed at which we're heading towards it, and from my perspective, the irresponsibility of, or the lack of political will, is extraordinary. And I just felt, okay, I've got to do this. And so that's the connection to my spiritual past, to put it that way. And also the fact that the activism I did was, is, was, and is grounded in this nonviolent philosophy, which is actually spiritual. It comes from the one and the sense that you are all one, whether whoever you're protesting about, whatever you're protesting about or trying to get the attention of, you know, it's one. You're coming, it's emerging from that. So that's the spiritual core of it, I think. So fast forward, you asked about the more radical. So what we were called to was at that point, that was the first step. I was part of, there were probably about 100 of us, 1900, who we trained. And the approach at that point was to go out and block motorways, particularly the big arterial motorway around London, which is, you know, a big thing to do. And has a big impact. And so we did a training, and it's incredibly well trained. It's very disciplined. You're very trained. You have to be, because it can be dangerous. So we went through this training, and then, you know, at a certain point, I knew the date, but I didn't know where I was going to go. You get a call, you're given the address on the phone. You don't write it down. You leave everything behind. You don't tell anybody because they would become implicated. So Steve didn't know. Leave your phone. You leave everything you've got, your wallet. You just take some cash and you disappear. And you go up to a designated place somewhere out in the country near these freeways. And you go to what they call, literally call a safe house, and you meet your team. The very first one I went to, Jeff, I went in the door, and there were these people in there, and I didn't recognize anybody, didn't know anybody. And I thought, wow, you know, we're going to go and do this tomorrow. How on earth are we going to do it as a team, right? And we had an incredibly skilled, you know, team leader, so to speak, or action leader, who is a beautiful older man from the north, who is a community worker and, you know, just lovely, beautiful soul, old soul. And at about 10 o'clock at night, he got us all together and it arrived. We were in this circle, about 19 of us, I think. And he just got everybody to say why they were there. And this took, I don't know, an hour, more than that. It was amazing, Jeff, because in that, you could hear something in every person. You could really feel where they were speaking from. And there was, you could feel that everyone was being driven by a very deep calling and sense of just being called, and a sense of responsibility, there's a lot of soul that were in the room, and we were from completely different backgrounds. 90% of the room were from the north, which I found very interesting, because the Northerners are very gritty. They're very, yeah, very community orientated, and they're used to hardship and for fighting for, they have a history of fighting for rights, et cetera, et cetera. So that was very profound. And by the end of the night, I felt we're a team. You know, I felt I knew these people. And then we spent the next hour going into all the sort of planning and the exactly down to it's like a military action, really, in terms of the precision of how you move and when you move and who does what and who your buddy is and what you do if the police appear and what you do. You know, it's incredibly planned, right down to where you're sitting on the road and how you enter and when you enter and et cetera, et cetera. So that was my first action, and it definitely was effective. It garnered a lot of press. In fact, we did those actions. That was September, right through to December, over 3 months. It was wall-to-wall coverage all that time, because the police couldn't. They didn't know where people were going to go, where they were going to show up. And the point, Jeff, is not just to get press. The reason that people do activism is you need the press, but the press is what allows you then to get into the media rooms and to have the conversations and to bring the issue to the government, because the whole point is obviously to put pressure on the government to change its policies. You can't do that without the media.
So when you, for instance, are in the street blocking the road. How long does that action last? Until you get broken up, or do you have a specific time? You're doing it for X number of hours, or how does that work?
You do it until it gets till the police arrive and arrest you, basically. And that could be a short period or it could be a couple of hours. Ideally, you don't want the police to arrive before the press because the whole point of it is you want it to get into the press so that, as I said, so it will enter the consciousness of the public. And they became alerted to this pretty early on. And they would turn up, they would phone and find out, or someone would phone them and say, we're going to be so and so this time, just before it happened. So the press would come because it became very controversial and very pressworthy, really. And I think intriguing, to be honest, because there was a mixture of public response. Some were really interested, some were very angry. And sometimes people would get very abusive, et cetera, et cetera. So it was a lot of action. So you would do it until the police arrived. And to be honest, that was often a relief because, everything would calm down because their job is to protect the motorists and to protect the protesters, so the activists. So once they came, if things were a little heated, it would calm down. So that's why the whole context that you're there has to be very strong. We did have leaflets and we had people that we called de-escalators, which I have actually done that role. After a while, I began also to do that role. And what you do is you keep between the activists and the motorists. If things get heated, you come in, you speak to them, you try to de-escalate the situation, and you offer to explain why you're there, et cetera. But sometimes you get people who are just angry. And I mean, you literally can have an SUV 10 inches from your face. What we do is you sit and you have a banner, which says why you're there, which is clear what the action is about. And people will rip that from your hands in a very, very strange way. And the very first time that happened, my impulse was to pull it back, to hang on. But you're trained to let go. The whole point is you let go. And if someone attacks you, you let go. You just go with it. You surrender. And a lot of people will drag you to the edge of the road, and you're trained to just quietly get up, with very no rapid actions. But you quietly go back. You sit down. And the whole point, Jeff, in this is you don't want the line to break. It can be very dangerous because cars will just try to charge through. Could be dangerous to spectators if they're there, to activists, obviously. So if someone gets dragged away, the other people move together very calmly but quickly. So you're constantly keeping that line. And you're trained too that even if you're attacked physically, you don't break the line. You can reach out and hold somebody if they're being hit, but you don't break it because it could be very dangerous. People don't tend to drive both of you, and obviously you can get bruised. And I was only at one action where it got worse than that, where there were sort of warehouses and people came out. It was like a spectator sport, and for some reason the police took a very long time to get there, and it was really thugs. That was not good. But at the same time, even at that action, there are conversations going on. And there was a whole conversation going on with this lorry driver who at first was very angry. But then in the end, when he drove away, Jeff, he put his thumbs up. Because when you can actually have a conversation with people about why you're there, everything changes. We had that happen multiple times. So as many times as there was a very, you could say, a very negative or challenging situation, there was the opposite. And the same with the police. There must have been hundreds, if not thousands, of conversations with arresting officers, many of them, because these were often country district police that were called in. In the city, it's a little different. But these police, you're with them for a long time until you actually get put into a cell. So you end up having these conversations about why you're doing it and what's happening. They're very curious, actually. Because they realize you're not a criminal, These people are not criminals. Why would they be putting themselves at risk like that? So we ended up having these conversations, and it was extraordinary because you would feel, I would say 8 times out of 10, the support once they understood.
It's an interesting alliance that you described as it's a relief when the police show up because they're there as much to protect you as anything else. They become sort of your allies.
Yeah, no, that's right. No, they are. And in a way, people don't begrudge them that you're going to be arrested. That's their job. You are doing something that's breaking the law. But how they do that matters. And obviously, there's some discrepancy in that. You know, some are very, not very pleasant. And others, are, like I said, are very interested. And when they actually find out, they can't overtly express their support, but they are supportive. You definitely feel that. Because they understand why you're doing it. And a lot of them have young families, and it turns out they are very concerned themselves. So it's an interesting area you enter there.
So how much time have you spent in prison? Or wherever they take you when they
Yeah.
arrest you?
Oh, I think I've been arrested probably 15, 16 times. So every time you're arrested, you go to a police cell, and they can't hold you more than 24 hours. But then I have been to prison as well, but that's different. That's because I went through a trial. The arrest is really the first step, and then, you know, you can go back and protest again after an arrest. But then at a certain point, if the police decide to prosecute you, you know, to charge you and prosecute you, then it goes further, and then there's a whole process. I've got two other trials coming up. Three, actually. I've been prosecuted actually many times, but it's complicated, but basically, very simply, there's different levels of criminality. The lowest one is obstruction of the highway or obstruction of an oil terminal or whatever, but you know, it's more on that level of obstructiveness. I have and do plead guilty to that. Yes, I was doing that. So you don't then need to go to prison or be sentenced to any particular punishment. But if you go to a court, you go to a mag what they call magistrate's court, and you plead put in your plea of guilty, and you can give what they call a you can give a mitigating statement, as which means why it's down in record why you did this. So it's not just I'm pleading guilty, but this is why I did the action. And if you know that's I've done that multiple times. I'm not quite sure how many, but what the reason I went to a jury trial and the reason I ended up going to prison was because they raised the level of criminality here to a law that sounds very innocuous. It's public nuisance, but public nuisance is deliberately vague and it can incur a 10-year jail sentence. It's like you're suddenly a felon. And I felt that what we were doing, that was an unjust equation. And a level of criminality that should not be attributed to activists, really social, any kind of social activist. So therefore, I didn't plead guilty. I pleaded not guilty. I didn't plead not guilty to the action. So I went to trial because of that. And that level of criminality, you go to a high court, which means you have a jury trial, which is usually for hardened criminals. I actually got a hung jury, which meant the jury couldn't decide, which is like is a good thing to get, particularly because that particular judge I had was a very tough judge, meaning that he literally created the trial for a guilty outcome. To give an example of how he did that, when you go to trial, you have the ambit of rulings, which are the rulings that that particular judge creates for that particular court. So he can, and you meet together, the prosecutor and the defense and the judge meet before the trial to talk through his rulings. And I was representing myself, which many of us did in the trial. So I was both the defendant and the defender, the lawyer. For myself. So I was at that meeting and he created rules for his court where we couldn't speak about the context of what we were doing. We couldn't speak about, we couldn't even mention climate. We couldn't mention fuel poverty. We couldn't mention nonviolent disobedience as being a social mechanism for social change. We weren't allowed to quote previous examples that it is a, you know, it's a known legitimate, well, not maybe not legitimate, but it's a mechanism of change, and a powerful one. And the irony, Jeff, is that Parliament Square here, the big square outside of Parliament, has multiple statues to Nelson Mandela, Gandhi, you know, these Millicent Fawcett, you know, these people who were considered at their time to be breaking the law through civil disobedience. So that's the irony. So I had that judge. So to get a hung jury out of that, was fortunate.
Well, that's tricky because then you can't say anything about your reasons and motives for doing it. So you're just on trial for the action itself, devoid of any context at all.
Exactly. And if you, which we did, you protest that in court, it's considered contempt of court, and you can be sent to prison right then and there. And so what we learned to do, and I attended many trials prior to mine with friends of mine or people I knew, and you develop a ways to work around that as much as you can. And one of the things is in your opening statement, you give as much information about yourself that creates the context of social justice or social action. You speak to the jury about who you are. So you come as close as you can to saying why you did it without saying why you did it. And the judge frequently would send the jury out because he knew we were pushing a line, but he can't actually send you to prison for contempt of court unless he's absolutely sure. But in the very
Correct.
end, I have to say it in my closing statement, I and one other, we did actually in your closing statement, which is the last statement just between you and the jury, the prosecutor can't get back to you. I did say why we did it. In effect, I committed a contempt of court because I felt it was what was happening in that particular court. It was really wrong. And I can't remember, but I remember saying something about without motive or context, you know, where's the justice? You know, it's like you're speaking in a vacuum. And he did not send me, he sent the jury out eventually, but he didn't send me to prison. And I think the only reason, Joe, he did say I'd committed contempt of court, but the only reason I think he didn't was because at that point this judge was under a lot of heat from the judiciary itself because of his. I was fairly far in with my trial. There'd been multiple others, and three people had been sent to prison for speaking about the climate. So he didn't want another one on his hands, I don't think.
So you're still involved, you're still doing actions, you're still motivated. And I see this as, in many ways, a very natural extension of your spiritual life. When we did spiritual practice together, it was extreme. So it doesn't surprise me that the extension of your spiritual life into the world would take a form that many would consider extreme. You're fighting for the environment, ultimately fighting for policy change. And you said initially you were seeing success. How do you feel it's going? Do you feel hopeful about the planet, about the environment, about our future?
I feel hopeful, Jeff. I don't know if hopeful is the right way. I feel positive, but it's not because there's been a lot of change at the political world. I think there's still a lot that has to happen. Because right now, I'm not only involved in sort of activism, this type of activism we're talking about, and partly too in Britain. That's been taken up by younger people, actually, by university massively. So right now, I'm also focused on other forms of activism, and part of our work at Third Space is profiling those who are making changes in the system that are also expressions of deeper impulse, but doing that. So I would say blends into some of the other forms of activism that you were describing in the beginning. But I think the reason I feel hopeful, I think it's completely non-guaranteed. I think our future, I think we're still on an incredibly dangerous course. And I think there's still enormous apathy. I think it's largely political. It's a lot to do with politics, that we're not pursuing the kind of changes that we need to, which could be there, because now also I'm very aware, as I'm sure most of your listeners are, that a lot of the so-called changes that need to happen or alternate ways of doing and thinking are there, whether it's in economics, it's in energy, it's in agriculture, all of these ways, they're all connected. It's not, climate has come out of, a deeper ideology, actually, I think, really, that affects everything. So it's that ideology which, if you want to take it to a spiritual level, you could say it's an ideology that's devoid of connection to the fact we are one and that we're a living, breathing, interconnected entity. That disconnection has created policies, it's created theories, it's created systems that have led us where we are. So it's a big thing. And that has not changed. The people who are directing things are still operating from that ideology. But at the same time, what gives me hope is that there's many, many more people, both in the global north and the global south, east and west, who are waking up to the fact that there's something deeply wrong with us, a civilizational worldview. And what they're waking up to is the fact we've become so disconnected from our source, right? From who we really are. And that in very different ways, according to different cultures, according to different contexts, people are starting to respond. And that includes the kind of activism we're talking about, but also includes people just creating new ways of doing things, in their communities, in their countries, in their cities, in their, and that's, it's coming more from the ground up, but it's coming from an expertise, some of which is, it's very complex, but some of which is coming from ancient wisdom that's being contemporized, brought into contemporary form. It's becoming a melding of the innovation of the West with the wisdom of the East, for example. I mean, there's many, many ways that this is happening, but it's coming from a human spirit, I think, that's recognizing that somewhere deep in our biggest collective, we've gotten off course. So, because of that, I feel hopeful. But I also realize there's a time element. And I think, to be honest, I think we're going to go through a lot more intense suffering as a planet before we get to the other side. I do, because just because things are happening so quickly, and because, again, the power, the power to actually, who's directing, quote, our future, is still in the hands of people who are operating from a very different worldview.
This brings us to a nice place to have a final comment. And it's another way to think about spiritual activism, which is what you were just saying, all of the manifestations of problem that we see. And of course, there's many. The environment, of course, as you said, is an existential threat. But it appears that our world is facing multiple existential threats. And if you've traced them back, some of us would say that they're all symptomatic of a spiritual disconnection. That deeply, as you said, we're disconnected from our source. We're disconnected from the unity of being that we are emerging from. And therefore, in a sense, all activism is at its root attempting to reconnect the human spirit to its source and create unity.
I think a lot of people have, they fear the word activism, or they fear what they think are the implications of activism. And I think it's really important. That's what you just described, which I agree with, because I'm struck by many sensitive people feel they have to protect themselves from the crises of the world, that it's too much. And I understand that it is too much. But at the same time, I think in a strange way, by responding to that, by not keeping it out, but actually responding to the deepest voice within us, which cares, because it doesn't feel separate, because we are one, we are connected. So of course we care. So shutting that care out, I think, is more depleting than not. So I would encourage people not to, and to allow themselves to be affected by it, because I think it touches the deepest part of ourselves, which is very strong and very resilient and very has a lot to bring to the situation. It doesn't mean everyone sits on a motorway at all, but there are myriad ways that we can respond, from the smallest to the largest, right, in multiple ways. And I think it's very important. I think at this point in our trajectory, our cosmic directory or global directory, whatever, universal trajectory, of course we can take, we should and can take time out to literally detach from the world. But I think that as an ongoing position is not healthy or realistic or spiritual, actually, because I think we are connected beings. And I think that we shouldn't be afraid of, quote, activism in any of the ways you were talking about. Even, I want to add to this too, it could even mean that you're voicing a truth, because many people are afraid of that, and for good reason, because voicing a truth these days, or a statement, you know, and I'm not saying truth with a capital T here, but we seem to have abandoned the deeper common sense that we all share, you know, the sense of what's right and wrong at the most fundamental level. I know there's multiple, it's a very complex world, and there's multiple complexities around both of those terms, but at the most fundamental level, a lot of us won't go there. You know, we turn away from, you know, from what our own conscience or our own heart tells us is right or wrong, and or something to support, put it that way. And I just feel like when we do that, we're denying the deepest part of ourselves.